Iran slams as nuclear terrorism an incident that hit its Natanz nuclear facility, calling on the international community to respond to the move. Iran reports 258 new deaths from COVID-19, the highest daily toll since early December last year. And reports say scores of fighters have been killed in fierce fighting for Yemen's strategic city of Mareb, with battles raging on several fronts. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here in Iran, which has condemned the latest incident at its Natanz uranium enrichment facility as an act of nuclear terrorism. Ali Akbar Salehi said the futile and desperate enemy move was aimed at blocking Iran's eye-catching nuclear progress. He called on the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency to respond to the move. Now, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said the country reserves the right to take action against the masterminds, perpetrators, and conspirators. On Sunday, Iran said the electricity distribution network of the Natanz facility had been affected in an incident. It said no casualties or contamination were caused. Last year, a blast hit a centrifuge assembly line in Natanz. Iran described it as an act of sabotage. Michael Springman is an American author and former U.S. diplomat. He believes Israel and the United States are behind the incident at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility.
Well, nuclear terrorism is the exact word. Israel, the apartheid entity, has hundreds of atomic bombs, vast amounts of poison gas and deadly bacteria, and no one pays any attention to this. Everyone ignores it, but they all focus on Iran, screaming that Iran continues to violate the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, said today. Haaretz is supposedly a liberal outlet in the Zionist entity. So this attack, and it was in fact an attack, was done with the full knowledge of the Israeli government and with the full knowledge of the American government. And in fact, the American Secretary of Defense, Austin, is traveling for meetings with Israel today, as far as I know. And they wouldn't get away with this if the Americans didn't look the other way.
A source close to Iran's nuclear negotiations says the removal of nuclear-related U.S. sanctions will not be enough. The source says that Washington needs to end all anti-Iran measures taken or relabeled by the Trump administration. The source told Press TV that the United States has also must remove the Obama-era sanctions, including the ISA and visa program measures. The source stressed that all those measures have to be removed indefinitely, adding that Iran will not accept any issuance of waivers instead of removing the sanctions regime. Now, the source noted that the verification of U.S. sanctions removal would take at least 3 to 6 months. The source said the U.S. representative will have to go back to Washington empty-handed if the U.S. does not accept Iran's conditions. Press TV has conducted an independent investigation and has asked Iranian sources about the nuclear talks. Accordingly, the removal of sanctions based on temporary 120-day or 180-day agreements through waivers, cessation, or suspension will not be acceptable to Iran. Political commentator Mostafa Khushchash says all sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran since the nuclear deal was signed in 2015 breached the accord.
All the sanctions that have been imposed after the striking and endorsement of the nuclear deal, including those that were imposed and came into practice under Obama, who was the first violator of the nuclear deal, they were all breaches of the nuclear deal and significant breaches of paragraphs 26 and 25, of course, that stress that Iran should enjoy the merits of the nuclear deal in order to be encouraged to continue to stay loyal to the deal. So they need to put an end to all of them. What Iran is requesting is blocking the way and the path to any kind of cheating in future. That's why Iran says, I want all sanctions terminated. First of all, all of them should be removed. Second, they should not be suspended. They should be terminated forever. Third, I need 3 to 6 months of verification. And fourth, that includes also the Obama-era sanctions. So in this way, then Iran can make sure that it would receive the economic merit.
Well, Iran has reported its highest daily deaths from COVID-19 pandemic since early December of last year. According to the health ministry, 258 people have died during the last 24 hours. Now, that brings Iran's total fatalities from the pandemic to nearly 64,500. The country also registered more than 21,000 daily new infections. Its total case tally is now above 2 million. On Saturday, a 10-day partial lockdown took effect in 23 out of 31 Iranian provinces, following a jump in daily cases during the past week. Non-essential businesses, as well as theaters and sports facilities, have been closed. Gatherings are limited to 15 people. Our correspondent Saman Kujuri says the 10-day lockdown will be extended if cases and deaths from COVID-19 continue to rise in Iran.
Well, it is said that what we see today, as I said, the fourth wave of the COVID-19, and this is said to be the UK variant of COVID-19, which has higher rate of infection. So hospitals are full so far, and a number of people who are going to hospitals and they're going to referring to doctors are rising up. According to officials, if people do not observe social distancing, if they do not wear a double mask or whatsoever, so this pandemic cannot be controlled. Officials believe that this 10-day lockdown is somehow temporary. If after this 10-day period of lockdown, partial lockdown, the assessment of the overall situation is still worse, it's not that much satisfactory, this 10-day period will be extended to maybe to 2 week time and more and more. What is so very much important is the national vaccination. Iran is already working on four different types of homegrown vaccines, and according to Iranian health officials, the first type of its homegrown vaccine is expected to be available in almost 40 days. And in almost 6 months, according to, again, authorities and health officials, Iran will have four homegrown developed Iranian newly developed vaccines in almost 6 months.
Well, reports from Yemen say at least 70 people have been killed in the latest clashes in the strategic city of Ma'arib. Those killed include Saudi-backed militants and forces loyal to the National Salvation Government. Earlier, Abdulatif Al-Washandi joined us from Sana'a to give us the details.
The Yemeni army is now controlling most of the mountains and hills, and this is a great danger to the Saudi forces. This has pushed Saudi Arabia to withdraw most of its heavy military equipment, and this comes while Hadi forces are preparing for new battles to defend the city from falling into the hands of the Yemeni army. Swedish envoy Peter Sundby arrived to Ma'arib 2 days ago. He met the national team from Yemen a week ago in Oman, and they have discussed a new initiative. This initiative is considered as a new copy of Stockholm Agreement. It seeks to reach a ceasefire in all the fronts in Yemen for humanitarian purposes. The problem is that the envoy cannot agree or provide guarantees that the initiative will be successful. The Sana'a government and Sana'a authorities said the initiative may not be a good solution as Yemen is still under siege despite Stockholm Agreement.
Now it's time for this hour's news review. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has warned Russia against acting, quote, aggressively towards Ukraine. In an interview, Blinken expressed concern about what he called Russia's action on the border with Ukraine. The top U.S. diplomat said Russia will face consequences and costs if it acts recklessly. Russia has said it is not moving towards war with Ukraine, but will defend its citizens in the eastern parts of the country. Those areas have recently witnessed fierce fighting between Ukraine's army and Russia-backed pro-independence fighters. Kiev has accused Moscow of amassing troops near its borders. Russia says its military movements are for self-protection against a NATO buildup. I'd like to welcome both my guests to this news review. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer at Westchester University out of Westchester, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway. Thank you both for being with us. John, take it away, your perspective of what is going on. We have obviously opposite perspectives coming out of Russia and Moscow.
Biden has appointed a very hawkish a cabinet, and all his appointments are what Sarah Flounders called think tank war hawks. And foremost among them is Anthony Blinken. And he's a longtime career State Department guy, diplomat. And Victoria Nuland is another one, Jake Sullivan. These are very extreme interventionists. Victoria Nuland has direct experience in Ukraine. She was one of, with Hillary Clinton, one of the architects of the coup in Ukraine that brought fascists into power. Biden was part of that as well, of course. Blinken has always been very hardline on Syria. He thought the U.S. didn't use nearly enough force against Assad. He was perfectly fine with the intervention in Libya. So now he is in a position of some prominence and power. And what you saw with Trump and Mike Pompeo was they didn't like NATO. They tried to bully NATO. The U.S. is now re-engaged with NATO. Blinken's a big NATO guy. Biden's a big NATO guy. They've been talking with Jens Stoltenberg and trying to kind of mend fences and get all their ducks in a row there and everybody on the same page propaganda-wise. Russia hasn't done anything here that warrants all this excitement. I mean, they move some troops around. The United States does that every week all over the world. Remember, the U.S. has 900 bases outside of its borders. Russia has, I think, 3, and they're all in former Soviet republics. So this is theater. This is public performance. It's the beginning of the Biden era, and they're laying groundwork. What's interesting, though, is if you read the Western press, the anti-Russia rhetoric is extraordinary. I mean, Putin is regularly referred to as a thug and a gangster, and so the American public is constantly being bombarded with anti-Chinese, especially anti-Russian and anti-Iranian rhetoric and propaganda. So that's really all this is. I mean, the United States is not going to intervene anytime soon, I don't think. Nothing's happening of any magnitude.
Okay. Lawrence, your take, where do you see this going? I mean, John has just said that he doesn't think that the U.S. really wants to intervene there. But then what is exactly going on, and why have they been making so much noise about what is happening there in Ukraine on the border?
Well, I think he's right that the United States is not going to, overly intervene, though they will up the armaments that they're sending into the Ukraine, particularly anti-tank weapons and that sort of thing. I think Biden feels particularly angry, I guess, at the Russians because of their relationship with Trump. So Trump was very, very easygoing with the Russians, and they intervened allegedly in our elections. Biden feels that he has to be very tough and very forward in this. On the other hand, the Russians, I guess, feel that for centuries and centuries, the Ukraine or large parts of the Ukraine were Russia, and that the fall of the Soviet Union put the Russian Republic at a military disadvantage, and NATO was the vehicle, the vector, through which this disadvantage has been created. I think that what the Russians are telling the Ukrainians and the Americans is like, look, I mean, we're going to establish perimeters. These perimeters will take up areas that we either think are strategically important to us, like the Crimea, or where there's a majority of Russian ethnic groups. And that's it. That's what we're reclaiming, that territory. I think the Americans are just going to have to eat that. I mean, they're just going to have to accept it. After all, I mean, you know, what would happen if Texas seceded? And not that that would be such a terrible thing, but what would happen if Texas seceded and all of a sudden you've got Russian military assistance going into Texas? The United States government would go nuts over this. So, and that's a sort of a comparison of how the Russians saw the loss of the Ukraine.
Okay.
And the Americans giving weapons to the Ukraine. So
right.
It's a tense situation, but I don't think it's going to lead to anything overly serious.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you so much, both of you, being with us on this news review. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer out of Westchester University. John Stepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. Continuing with more news this hour, anti-coup demonstrators have once again taken to the streets of Myanmar to protest a junta's deadly crackdown. Protesters took to the streets in several cities and towns, including the southeastern city of Dawei. Teachers and students were among them. Myanmar's junta took power on February the 1st, it detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other civilian officials. That ignited daily nationwide protests, which have continued despite the military's crackdown. So far, over 700 civilians have been killed. Now, that's according to a local monitoring group. Myanmar's junta has pressed ahead with its crackdown, despite international calls to stop it. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5. 1.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
A new survey of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading More than two-thirds of American students want police out of schools. Stay tuned for the details, please. A new study of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. One-third said they feel targeted by police based on an aspect of their identity, such as race, primary language, sexual orientation, or gender identity, and students reported bullying and sexual harassment by police at multiple public schools. When asked what does make them feel safe at school, students overwhelmingly said teachers and friends, and more than two-thirds said police should be removed from school altogether. Only 16% of students said police make them feel safe. Courtney Blake, a ninth grader in New York City and youth leader with the Urban Youth Collaborative, which conducted the survey locally, said the findings make her feel disgusted and angry at the system. These are the experiences of young children and teenagers across the country, yet it feels personal because they reflect how I feel, Blake said in a statement. At school, police don't make me feel safe. Instead, they make me feel like I did something wrong. The in-depth survey of recent and current students of public schools in Oregon, New York, Nevada, and New Jersey reveals broad support for the student-led movement to remove police from schools and increase funding for teachers, student programming, and mental health supports. Activists are relatedly fighting to end the school-to-prison pipeline, which refers to policies and practices that isolate students and color immigrants and students with disabilities from supportive learning environments and instead funnels them toward the criminal legal system. This puts students at risk of being incarcerated or, in the case of undocumented students, deported or separated from family members. Redirecting funding from police departments to education and social programs is also a long-standing goal of the Movement for Black Lives that has inspired nationwide protests against the over-policing of communities of color. Of the students surveyed who report seeing cops at school, 50% said they have seen police interrupt learning to remove students from the classroom, and 1 in 5 reported that the cops verbally harass or make fun of students. Alarmingly, students reported sexual harassment by police in 3 of the 4 local areas surveyed, and more than a quarter said they have seen students arrested at school. Of the students who reported a police presence at school, 32% said they saw police at school on a daily basis, and 95% said they see cops at least once a month. Students also reported frequent interactions with security guards. 30% of black students said they interact with security guards on a daily basis. Metal detectors are more common at majority black and brown schools, and students of color were more likely to be searched and have belongings taken by police or security guards than white students. In the Las Vegas School District of Clark County, more than a quarter of students reported that they or someone they know has been pepper sprayed by police at school. School police in the district made headlines after using pepper spray in response to fights between students in recent years, with dozens of students and faculty pepper sprayed in one high-profile incident. Schoolyard fights can be used to justify the presence of police in schools, but when asked what they would like to see more of in school, students overwhelmingly chose additional resources and support for students and teachers over police and security. For example, 78% said they would like to see better mental health support and youth-led programs dedicated to increasing access to college, while only 8% said they would like more police. The survey was conducted by students and community groups that support the movement to remove police from schools and focused largely on diverse public schools located in urban and suburban areas. Schools where at least 75% of students are black are more likely to have police officers and on-site security than schools where a majority of students are white, according to federal civil rights data. Many students know that black and indigenous adults and teens, for example, are more likely to be targeted, brutalized, and even killed by police outside of a school. Nationally, reams of data show that students of color and students with disabilities are disproportionately referred to police or arrested while at a school, and black students are more than twice as likely as white students to be disciplined by cops. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, students with disabilities are more than 3 times as likely to be sent or arrested by the police, a disparity that is much wider in some states. A study conducted in New Orleans during the 2018 to 2019 school year found that only 40% of black students said they felt safer around police at school, compared to 69% of white students. What did we do to deserve police in our schools? Blake said. We deserve support and resources, not police. Racial justice experts say students of color have always been systematically excluded from learning and marginalized at schools and universities. reflecting the deeply entrenched racism and white supremacy in education going back decades. Civil rights groups argue that students with disabilities, as well as Black, Indigenous, and other students of color, often have to attend public schools with fewer resources, accommodations for students with disabilities, and supports for staff, making teachers more likely to call on police to deal with behavioral problems. The survey also found that 56% of students who say their school is majority Black report going through metal detectors on a daily basis, which can make a school feel more like a jail. Among the students who have metal detectors in their schools, 34% of Black students report that their belongings have been confiscated, compared to 14% of white students. Black and Latino students were also more likely to have been asked to remove their shoes to be searched than white students.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You'll clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward And the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze where you've got it all over you, you're wet through something bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown Land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, okay.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole, and they crunched them up with the dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises, because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for the sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is a sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 2,4-D. Tests on one 2,4-D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 2,4-D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost 7 times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself. And we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and then not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas. And it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he is constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cod liver's growing nicely.
Bottom line is they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There is no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review.
Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.